We're just getting ready to go back on the record. Mr. Wieczorek, are you back on the line? I thought I heard somebody dial in.
Yeah, Mr. Wieczorek is online.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we've got all three commissioners back, so back on the record. Mr. Stephenson, are you going to recall Mr. Gerhardsen? Or?
Yes, Your Honor. We had just a point or two that we'd like to clarify the record on.
Okay. Good. Remember that you're still under oath. Okay. Mr. Stephenson, go ahead.
Mr. Gerhardsen, do you recall a question, I believe, from Commissioner Crosius asking about Otter Tail's tariff book and the energy component being reduced, I believe, for the LGS class because of this rate case?
Yes.
And is there anything you want to clarify about your response to that?
There is. After we took our break, my recollection came back to me that there's an additional change that's occurring in this rate case that affects the energy component of the rate book, and that is that coming out of the last rate case, we had a compliance obligation to move all fuel and purchase power costs from our base rates and into the fuel clause. It's just a mechanical thing, and it doesn't materially affect the bills that customers pay. But when you look at the rate book changes, and especially the energy component of any of the rates in the rate book, you would have to recall that a big reason for the energy price reductions in the rate book is associated with just moving those costs from the base rates to the fuel clause in compliance with the last rate case order. That is, I think, becoming more of a conventional way amongst the utilities to recover the fuel and purchase power all in the fuel clause rather than just recovering the overs and unders in the fuel clause. So that was the clarification I thought might be helpful as you interpret the information in that rate book.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
We have no further clarifications for Mr. Gerhardsen.
Mr. Pelham.
No questions.
Mr. Savakul.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Gerhardsen, just continuing on from that issue. So really it's a zero-sum game. Well, it appears that there is a drop for LGS rates. It's not an overall drop. It's a drop in base rates, which will be shifted and then recovered in the energy rider. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, and the example that we pointed out, and I would point out that isn't only for the LGS rate. It's for actually all customers that, and I think all customers pay a fuel, pay the FCA. There might be a couple of small rates that don't have that component. But all of them would have previously had fuel and purchase power costs set in the last rate case included in the base rates that are reflected in the rate books and in the tariff sheets in the rate book. But because of the obligation coming out of the last rate to move those to all fuel clause recovery in this rate case, the energy component of the rates will now no longer reflect the fuel and purchase power costs.
Okay, thank you. Then I just want to come full circle. The last time you and I talked on a stand here, we were speaking about an 86% of class cost responsibility. And am I correct in assuming that's coming from a calculation off of Exhibit 51?
I believe it is. I don't have that exhibit in front of me, but I believe it is. That's the table that we had spoke about earlier about the relative impacts.
Okay. And so if you were to do the same calculation for the LGS, does it sound approximately right that LGS would be paying 126% of cost using that same analysis?
I haven't done the math, but that sounds about right and would make sense given that there's a slight under-recovery for the residential. There would be a slight over-recovery for the large general service.
Thank you. I've got no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Gerhardsen.
Mr. Wazorek.
Nothing from me, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackel.
Just one, based on Mr. Savickle's questions. Is it common for the classes, the different rate classes, to not necessarily recover the revenue from those classes, recover exactly their costs? Is that a common occurrence or an odd, one-off occurrence?
It's a common occurrence.
And over the last 100-and-some years of regulatory history, which you've experienced, no.
All of. Many of.
We've both experienced. Mm-hmm. What are some of the policy reasons for that that have been given in the past when, because the numbers have always shown that certain classes are over-recovering and certain are under-recovering. What are some of the policy reasons given for that?
You know, generally the policy reasons, they're explained in somewhat in detail, I think, at least Dave Prozek's testimony, I think, is that generally speaking, there's some suppression sometimes to moderate dramatic impacts, sometimes referred to as rate shock or rate continuity concepts. That might be one. There are other reasons to do so that can be to incentivize certain consumption patterns in certain rate groups. So if you wanted to incentivize conservation, you might charge them, well, I don't know if that would necessarily cause that, but it could, to cause them to consume less if their prices are higher.
So in your experience with this commission and this commission's precedent, has this commission used the cost of service study as an exact barometer of where the rates should be or as a guide?
They've used it as a guide, and generally speaking, it's been my experience that the commission desires that we get closer to cost with an aspirational goal of arriving at cost at some point. It's probably an aspirational goal as much as anything.
Would it be possible for Otter Tail to send in perhaps a late-filed exhibit that would show if the total residential was not put in the customer charge, but some lesser amount was, and then the rest was recovered in the volumetric charge, could Otter Tail produce an exhibit to show the effects of that on the customer?
I could, and I want to separate two things that I think I've actually convoluted here so mistakenly. There's two things that we're talking about. One is when we talk about the 85 or 84% and the percentage that Mr. Savickle talked about, that's really just in the class allocations. So that doesn't have anything to do with the fixed charge that any customer group is paying. There's another thing that's occurring, which is that there's a fixed charge. Once we determine how much any rate class should pay, we split that into the various rates that are going to be assigned to the rate class, and then we attempt to derive what should be recovered in a fixed charge, a demand charge, or an energy charge. So there's two things that are going on. My apologies for that little sidebar, but it seemed like I was maybe creating some confusion. And, of course, we can provide you the information that you've asked for.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay. Commissioners. Commissioner Crocius.
How are you holding up?
Well.
Good. Okay.
You tell me.
I don't have any other questions.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
Chairman Chrisman.
I'm done, Your Honor.
Mr. Fedorce.
No more questions for me.
Okay. You can step down.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cephas.
Judge Ward, did you want to reserve a place for that late-filed exhibit now?
We'll talk about that at the end.
We rest, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Pelham.
Thank you, Your Honor. PSC advocacy staff would call to the stand Victor Shook.
Mr. Shook, you've heard the warning. You know the law. I'll have you raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding.
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Shook, could you please state your name for the record?
My name is Victor Shook.
And tell, for the record, tell the commissioners what you do here.
I'm a public utility analyst employed by the North Dakota Public Service Commission.
All right, Mr. Shook, is it true that you prepared some testimony today to present to the commission?
Yes, I have.
All right, could you please proceed with that?
Sure. Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Victor Shook. I'm testifying on behalf of advocacy staff in this proceeding. I'm testifying today in support of the settlement agreement between Otter Tail Power, Public Service Commission advocacy staff, Walmart Stores Incorporated, and the Midwest Large Energy Consumers. There have been a number of different numbers thrown around already this morning, and I'm going to try to not add to that to avoid some additional confusion, but I'm going to try to cover what I think are the main points of the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement provides for a total North Dakota rate base of approximately $364 million, base rate revenue increase of $7.3 million or $5.6, depending on what you're comparing that to, a 9.77% return on equity, what I believe is an equitable allocation of the revenue increase between the classes of service, and increases to the customer charge, as well as a few various tariff and miscellaneous changes. The North Dakota rate base is, as the company stated, about double that was approved in the last rate case. From what I was able to ascertain from our review, the dramatic increase in rate base was primarily due to environmental upgrades made to the Big Stone Generation Facility in South Dakota and the Hoot Lake Coal Facility in Minnesota, and a number of large transmission projects running among the three-state region that Otter Tail serves. I believe the total rate base is an appropriate representation of the value of Otter Tail's property used and useful for the service and convenience of the public in North Dakota. The base rate revenue increase, this is where we get a little bit messy with all these funny numbers, so I'm gonna try to stay relatively clear here. So the number we agreed to in the settlement agreement is approximately $7.364 or $7.4 million, depending on how you're trying to estimate, which is a reduction of approximately $5.7 million from the company's original request of $13.1 million. That decrease is made up of the following kind of main points. $1.35 million of the reduction is due to the drop in the return on equity from the company's originally requested 10.3% down to the 9.77% that we agreed upon. There are $1.38 million in reductions to disputed expenses. Those expenses are stock and incentive-based compensation and amortization periods used for rate case expenses and non-plant excess accumulated deferred income taxes. The remaining difference is what I would attribute to the actual income tax expense reduction and amortization of plant excess accumulated deferred income taxes. So depending on how you do that math, there could be a couple of numbers, but the company, I believe earlier, said $4.8 million was the total reduction due to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and I would agree that that is accurate. The 9.77% ROE, I believe, ensures the customers are not paying an overinflated rate of return, yet recognizes the company's historical performance. The ROE translates into overall rate of return, or ROR, of 7.64 when considered in concert with the company's long and short-term debt. I believe this ROE and ROR provide Otter Tail with a just and reasonable rate of return on its property used and useful for the service and convenience of the public in North Dakota. Class revenue distribution in this case, I believe, is a fair balance between true cost-based allocation and a certain amount of gradualism. Assigning the increase to the classes based purely on cost would result in very large increases to certain classes while resulting in decreases for others. Please, we're able to employ a reasonable amount of gradualism to temper the increases to the classes, yet at the same time make significant improvements to the contribution differences between those classes. Customer charges, as you've noted earlier today, are increasing for nearly every class of customer. It's based upon the company's marginal cost study, as they've stated. Increasing this customer charge has the effect of stabilizing the company's revenues as well as customer bills, thereby reducing risk. So based on the facts of this case, I believe these rates and charges are necessary to provide just and reasonable rate of return on Otter Tail's property used and useful for the service and convenience to the public in North Dakota. Furthermore, the proposed rate schedules are designed in such a manner that they result in the basis of charge to its customers that is just and reasonable without unjust discrimination. Just trying to make lawyers happy there. The other miscellaneous changes to the settlement included in the settlement agreement are tracking of the production tax credit accumulated deferred income tax regulatory asset. That's a mouthful. I can explain that if you need to. It's a result of the company being unable to utilize the full value of some of the production tax credits in the year they were earned. Revision helps ensure ratepayers will not be paying a return on that regulatory asset from now until the time the next rate case happens, but rather only until the company is able to utilize those PTCs on their tax return. And then finally, in accordance with the prior rate case settlement, the company will be removing the costs of reagents and emissions from base rates and moving them into the energy adjustment rider. This is consistent with how other North Dakota investor-owned utilities track such expenses. So due to these factors and in the interest of Otter Tail's North Dakota ratepayers, I recommend the commission adopt this settlement agreement. Look forward to any questions you may have.
Anything else, Mr. Brown?
Nothing further. This witness is open to questioning.
Okay. Mr. Stephenson.
No questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Savicle.
Nothing, Your Honor.
Mr. Wazorek.
Nothing, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
Victor, why should the commission consider it acceptable to allow those economic development costs that would they? I realize they were not specifically addressed in the settlement, but therefore by implication they're allowed, especially with the language the way it is now. What are the good reasons for that, or
so,
if any?
I guess I would say the reason from my perspective, since we are talking about a settlement, since it is a settlement, there's give and take. There were some items that we gave on and some items that we kind of held firm. And from my perspective, it was more important to get some of the disallowances we did get rather than trying to get the economic development disallowance. So from our perspective, it was more valuable to get those other disallowances.
But there is a specific commission precedent on those costs, given that they carved it out of the last settlement. Is that correct?
Yes.
So some of the other disallowances that you gained that you thought offset having to give this one up, are you talking about the dollar value of them, or are you talking about the policy implication of them?
More so the dollar value. I mean, the policy is something, you know, I think every settlement we ever sign always says this doesn't necessarily upset or set precedent. Since most of our cases result in settlements, we don't necessarily see one of those as setting it. It certainly helps our position for future settlements, but it doesn't set that precedent. But so I would say primarily the dollar value was what was important, along with what was associated with that dollar value. So some of the disallowance related to stock-based compensation, which if you're comparing, let's say it's the same dollar amount, $200,000 of economic development for North Dakota communities versus $200,000 paid to executives in the form of stock in a corporation, we chose to go for the latter.
And I'm just wondering why. I'm not criticizing. I'm
sure.
Just wondering what if the values were equal, the dollar values.
The values were equal. There was lots of separate and unique items and lots of different dollar values. I'm sure there was a couple of them we could have totaled up to equal about that $200,000 economic development amount. But I guess relatively early, I would say we're not pushing terribly hard on that versus some of these other more problematic for us items.
And if that catch-all paragraph at the toward the end of the settlement that says the positions of the parties in the position of Otter Tail in the rebuttal testimony is adopted. If that were rejected by the commission or tweaked or whatever, what would be staff's position?
We would be completely okay with that.
That's all I have. Thanks.
Commissioners, Commissioner Crocius.
There's been a fair amount of discussion on getting rebalancing revenue requirements amongst the different classes. I'm still trying to get my arms, well, maybe not. That's not a good way of putting it, but moving it or improving the gap, if you will, the shortfall by 86% seems like a pretty big jump in terms of trying to rebalance it. I think it seems like that's more than a reasonable amount of gradualism. It seems like that's a pretty big swing at it.
It's a good swing. I'll give you that. I mean, I couldn't say if it's more than reasonable. I guess in my opinion, it is reasonable. Otherwise, we wouldn't have agreed to it in the settlement. It's probably farther than we've been able to come in other cases. I think all of the parties worked hard to come to something that everyone thought was reasonable, and that's the numbers we've put forward. You know, certainly if we went at this with no regard for customer bill impacts, and we would have just went to the straight cost of service allocation, which would have been a much higher allocation to the residential class. So we as a group, tried to temper that cost, straight cost of service allocation, to a more balanced approach.
In comparison to other IOUs, which I realize they're not a part of this, but how does this position Otter Tail Power in terms of cost of service allocation? Would they be head and shoulders?
I think each investor owned is going to have a different cost of service. I mean, they would each have to do their own study to figure out what costs should be associated, or what costs should go to which classes. So it's going to be different depending on which utility you're looking at. Particularly, each utility may have similar rate schedules. You know, like they're all going to have a residential class. They're going to have some kind of a large or small general class. But otherwise, it gets really variable. I mean, I don't think the other investor-owned utilities have a farm category, for example. I think only one of them has an irrigation category. So it's difficult to compare the classes exactly. And particularly, like I said, if you're looking at that purely cost-to-service allocation, it's certainly going to be different between the different IOUs. But maybe if this is kind of getting after where your question is going, is would this bring Otter Tail closer to being to the cost of service than the other utilities are to their cost of service allocation to the classes? I honestly couldn't tell you off the top of my head. We haven't looked at NSP in the recent past since I've been here at that level. MDU, I believe, is farther away as far as if you're looking at just the residential class. That's really the only one you can kind of compare apples to apples in this situation. I think MDU's residential class would be further away than Otter Tail's would be to cost of service.
So not to say that it's the right way to look at it, but, and I think this question was asked earlier, but it's not unusual for there to be these discrepancies.
To be between the true cost of service and what's actually being granted for the distribution, yes, that's common to not be exactly on.
And I think it would be fair to say that back in 2008, you had a completely different commission.
I think that's pretty fair to say.
Which I wasn't here, and I don't believe the other two commissioners were there. So it does change commissions in terms of of outlook and view. Does this do anything, in your opinion, for truing these numbers up or getting them closer to being trued up to reflect actual cost of service between the different classes? Does this do anything, in your opinion, to help attract capital? Or is this so far in the weeds that it really doesn't come into play?
Which part are you?
Capital, in terms of just going to the capital markets.
Right. The settlement agreement, I think, in its entirety is going to be positive for attracting capital. I think from what my understanding is of capital markets, they generally respond more positively to settlement type of proceedings versus fully litigated proceedings. So it will be positive from that aspect. Additionally, the return on equity that's been allowed, we believe, is more than sufficient to attract capital.
All right. I don't have any other questions. Thank you, Victor.
Welcome.
Chairman Christman. In testimony, Mr. I never was sure how to pronounce it. Dismukes?
Dismukes.
Dismukes. Says I determined that Otter Tail's cost of equity is less than the proxy group because Otter Tail's requested capital structure has a significantly higher common equity ratio than the proxy group. A higher common equity ratio means its financial risk is lower. Goes on to explain why he was recommending 8.31%, which he points out remains above my highest cost of equity model result.
I think that was coming from Mr. Rothschild's testimony.
Was it? Okay. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Advocacy staff's testimony.
Yes.
Okay. And then later on, says that the company's recommendation of 10.3 is unreasonably high because of errors in the cost of equity calculations. So now this ROE is much closer to the company's recommendation than to advocacy staff's.
It is.
So do you now distance yourself from these comments, or is this close enough that these comments are no longer accurate at the 9.77% number?
So kind of like with the other parts of the settlement, it's a balance that I think we struck. We believe 9.77 is a fair and reasonable rate of return, both for the company and for the customers. Do we still believe 10.3 is too high? Absolutely. Do we think that we could have convinced the three of you to give us an 8.31? Probably not. Do we think that the calculations support it? Yes.
But if 8.31 is already above any of the models, is 9.7? You're comfortable with the testimony that that's just and reasonable?
Yes.
Still feel that rate continuity is generally an important objective in the rate design process?
Yes.
And this was an assessment of the company's original proposal. These outcomes raise doubts about the seriousness of the company's commitment to the goals of rate continuity. These rates that are established, especially in the residential, aren't vastly different from those originally proposed. They are less.
Yes.
But are you comfortable in an assessment that these meet the objectives of rate continuity for this much of a step in one step?
Yes. I do. So I agree. There, you know, the initial ask by the company was a very large ask relative to most rate cases we have ever seen. There was a big reduction from that, a lot of it due to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. But I think all parties did additional work to reduce that even further. I think the end result is reasonable. I understand the concern for rate continuity. I still think this is reasonable with that in mind.
Okay, now I want to go back to the economic development business.
Okay.
Is that a core business of Otter Tail Power?
No.
Is it something that is is really definable? Can you ever say that a certain effort in an economic development project caused that project to occur?
It's very difficult, if not impossible, to prove up economic development.
If the company believes that $200,000 of economic development costs built into rate base is good, is there any possible way then to define that later $300,000 or $400,000 or $5 million wouldn't be better?
They could certainly make that argument. If I was still sitting in the same chair at that time, I would argue against that strongly.
Would you disagree with me strongly if I said that I argue just as strongly against this $200,000 as you would against the higher numbers I stated?
Sure, and that's a fair argument as well. Kind of like I stated, I guess there is give and take when we go through these settlements, and in my opinion, the things we got were worth these things, such as economic development, that we gave up.
Are there other things that I'm missing? Isn't most of the give and take, though, that you're talking about having to do with core functions of the business, of providing electricity to the consumers, as opposed to going around doing economic development projects?
A lot of the disallowances that we do have in the settlement agreement for incentive compensation and stock compensation, so a good portion of that, probably the dollar value is more than the $200,000 for economic development, was for people not employed by the utility portion of the company. It was corporate employees, board of directors, for example, their stock-based compensation.
Okay. And no other questions?
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Just following up briefly on that, I think that where Randy's going is a trouble spot for me, too, in terms of there's the dollar values and then there's the principal.
Sure.
And the economic development stuff is just, it's one-off. It just doesn't fit. So, I appreciate the list of reductions that you guys did negotiate, and there are some significant things there that are really important, and I'm glad that they're gone. But this economic development one is still lingers out there as a problem. It's not a huge dollar amount, but it just, sure. It doesn't feel like if we agree with that, we're going to hear the end of it anytime soon. So, anyway, we'll deal with that. Since we're talking about the adjustments, I've got the list in the chart from,
Mr. Smith.
Ralph Smith. And then I also am noting the difference in the revenue deficiency, which is basically what you're allowing for revenue, which you settle on. So staff originally identified a revenue deficiency of about $900,000, and the company was at $9.71 million, I think, after their adjustments from the tax, et cetera. I don't know that those were their initial numbers. I think I took the tax stuff off.
Yes, they...
So that was their revenue deficiency, and you settled at $7.3 million. So staff gave a lot more than they did, judging by those numbers. You were originally at $900,000 and ended up at $7.4 million, and they were at $9.7 and ended up at $7.4. So aside from the adjustments that they did give in terms of the employee gifts, investor relations expenses, incentive compensation, stock-based compensation, stock grants, executive survivor and supplemental retirement plan, rate case expenses. Aside from those cuts, where else, what else makes up the difference between what you guys originally proposed, 900,000, and that where we ended up, 7.4 million in revenue deficiency. Is that the ROE?
A big portion of it is ROE.
Do you know how much, Fitch?
I could calculate it. So ROE in this case is worth about $238,000 per 10 basis points. So if you go from, let's say...
Was that in English?
Yes.
Could have been in French for as much as it means to me.
So 10 basis points is 0.1 of a percentage. So if you go from 8.3 to 8.4, that's 10 basis points.
Okay.
So if our initial was 8.31, if you go from 8.31 to 9.31, that's 100 basis points, or about $2.3 million.
Okay.
So we're beyond that, so we're probably closer to $3.5 million if you look at where we started at 8.31 up until where we ended at 9.77.
Okay.
In addition to that, one of the larger items, there was a on the chart you're looking at there, line 15, payroll expense, it was a total value of about $1.3 million there. It appeared to us that there was some differences in budget versus actuals historically. So the company would, let's say, for example, our budget for payroll is $2 million, and we're coming in at $1.5 million every year. Well, we're not going, you're not paying out that half a million, so we should recoup that for customers when we calculate the actual expenses. Well, in actuality, we were able to determine with the company that that was just due to how we were looking at it. There's a loaded and an unloaded payroll cost when you're looking at fringe benefits and things like that, and we weren't comparing them correctly.
Okay.
And that's what, so we...
So that's another big one.
That, it is. It's a huge one. And then along with that, there's some other items there. So payroll taxes, item number 19, kind of goes hand in hand with that $1.3 million. If you reduce the payroll expense, you have to reduce the payroll tax expense. And really, that's going to be the majority of it.
It still seems like we're a ways off unless the revenue, the ROE is more than like $3 million.
It very well could be, so let me break out the trustee.
Is it possible to get a list of that that would add up, do you think?
I think we could, but I need to know which number you want to go from and to.
Yeah, that's always...
just because there's so
from
many...
From the revenue parts. Deficiency that you guys identified to the where you settled 7.364336.
So you want our 900,000?
Yep.
Versus the 7.3 million. We can certainly do that.
Okay. All right. So how did you pick 9.77 on the ROE? How did you guys land there?
That is where the settlement agreements concluded.
Okay.
It was certainly back and forth.
All right. Okay. So here's more of just a philosophical question for you as an advocacy person. When you see that a company invested $672 million in capital over a four-year period without a rate increase, what does that say to you?
Well, without looking at all the details behind that, I guess... try to figure out how could you possibly do that? Where did the money come from without necessitating a rate case? And the answer actually is they have riders.
Oh.
So they spent that money and there was mechanisms in place for them to recover or start recovery of those expenditures. So the environmental things were recovered through the environmental rider. The renewable rider was out there for their wind farms that they have added. Transmission riders out there to track both the MISO and SPP costs, as well as transmission projects that they had discussed, you know, smaller ones that they don't go through the MISO processes for.
Okay, good. Can you talk through, you said you would, so now I'm going to ask you to do that when you gave your opening comments. On the PTC issue.
PTC, excess accumulated deferred income tax.
Yes,
regulatory assets. That's a fun one.
That one, we're still flowing through the PTCs when they're obtained, customers are getting the credit for them on their in their rates.
Correct.
And then that amount goes someplace, and how that's being dealt with changes in this versus how it's been done, correct?
Yeah, so it's what's happening before is different than how it's going to be happening in the past, which is different than what should normally happen anyway. So
just let's talk about what they used to do and what they're going to be doing.
Well,
in the settlement.
I'm going to talk about all three scenarios.
It's
going to be fun. So normally, you are able to utilize all of your production tax credits on your income tax statement. You calculate that in when you're determining the revenue requirement for, so prior to the customer, the company having that issue, that's how all of their wind projects were in the renewable rider. So when they calculated the annual revenue requirement, it included the full value of PTCs for that year, and that reduced the revenue requirement by that amount. No more additional calculations necessary for the
So that's how the customers were being charged.
Right. Now, a couple of years ago, the company had issues using all of its PTCs in the year they were earned because of bonus depreciation. So when they were calculating this revenue requirement, they were still calculating the PTCs in that year earned when they were determining that revenue requirement, but they said, hey, I'm kind of giving the customers a loan of this PTC money because I can't use this year. So they created this regulatory asset, which shows up as essentially a rate base item for them. So until such time they're able to use this on their tax return, customers will pay a return on that amount.
Okay.
It's
like a loan, like you said.
Exactly.
Okay.
So if the settlement agreement is approved as proposed, once final rates are put into place, the value of the amount of production tax credits the company had recorded in that revenue requirement but not been able to use on their tax return, which I don't know the exact value, but it's in excess of $10 million, that will remain in the renewable rider until such time that the company can use it on their tax return. And in the interim, we would continue to pay that return on it, but only up until the point the company uses it. As soon as that happens, the use of it on their tax return erases that rate base item.
Okay.
And had that provision not been in the settlement agreement, this would have been part of the calculation of base rates. So even, let's say, next year, the company was able to utilize that $10 million on their tax return, the customer's rates were still going to be calculated to provide a return on that over $10 million item until the next rate case.
Hmm. Well, that's a good catch, because that wouldn't have been appropriate.
It would be a significant dollar amount for the company.
Yeah. Okay, good. That's helpful. And then finally, the customer charge. We've agreed to this shift in other utilities, and I think from a general principle standpoint, I am supportive of it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really large jump in one fell swoop, all in the customer charge.
It is.
Did you try to get it partway and volumetric, you know, some charge, or how did advocacy get convinced to this?
Again, I guess it's what's one of the give and take items. I think it's a balance. I did compare. I'm looking for my sheet here. I made myself a little cheat sheet. When you compare the basic customer charge of Otter Tail, or what we're proposing Otter Tail would have compared to NSP and MDU, it's really not quite as drastic as it may seem. If you look at residential, that's the kind of the easy one that kind of crosses all these boundaries. Residential basic service charge for MDU is about $14 a month, and NSP, I think it's about $14.50, in fact. And there's lots of other categories of customer in these others. It's just kind of hard to compare apples and apples because there's not the same type of customers as you go throughout. I agree.
Do you think that the customers care about that? Like, I mean, should that be the basis for doing it?
I'm sure some customers would care. I think it depends on who you are as a customer. If you are a large user of energy or a smaller user of energy. If you're a small user of energy, you want that customer charge to stay where it is or go down. If you're a large user, you're probably going to benefit more from it, the basic charge going up versus the volumetric.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this is a good balance. I mean, for the residential, for example, 1523 isn't an unreasonable amount for a basic service charge for a customer. I'm not a customer of an IOU myself. I'm a customer of a co-op, and I think mine is 25.
So almost 100% of the residential is being recovered from the customer charge?
Yes.
That doesn't seem to support gradualism in this particular context.
In the context of the basic service charge, you could make that argument, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I get that the bill is probably going to be similar for the average ratepayer, but are you satisfied that is where the company needs to be to effectively collect their fixed costs?
Yes.
So from that standpoint, it's justified?
Yes.
And then you heard Mr. Gerritsen talking about how they have sort of a different mix of customers, that they don't have the low-income, low users. It's more of a low-income, high user. Did you look at that information? Was that part of your willingness to accept that?
And I do accept what they were saying with that. I did see that in Mr. Prazik's testimony. That was actually the first time in any rate proceeding that we've had since I've been here where someone was able to, in any definitive way, identify low-income customers. Before, it was mm-hmm. kind of more anecdotally, well, we think low-usage customers are low-income customers. And this doesn't explain exactly 100% who the low-income people are, but it goes further. To helping try to explain who they are. And I think it's impossible to 100% identify, you know, this category is where your low-income people are, because I do think that they're going to be scattered throughout both low-usage, high-usage, and everything in between.
Okay. All right, I think that's it for me. Thanks, Vic.
Mr. Pelham, any follow-up?
No follow-up.
Mr. Stephenson.
No follow-up, Your Honor.
None, Your Honor.
Mr. Wieczorek.
None, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Just one. Vic, the staff exhibit that you're going to make to itemize kind of moving from the 900,000 to the 7.3, that would include these expense items, operating expense items that are in the settlement, I'm guessing, so that one would know whether these negative numbers are the whole amount they were asking for or just part of the amount they were asking for.
Correct.
Can you
yes.
make it sufficiently detailed to tell us that?
Yes, we will have to go to that level.
All right.
Yes, these,
thank you.
The final are slightly different than the original ask.
Yes.
For some for certain items.
Yes, thank you. That's all I wanted.
Anything else, commissioners? Commissioner Crocius? Chairman?
Sorry.
Mr. Fedorchik. No. Okay. Thanks, Victor. Mr. Pelham.
Advocacy staff rests.
Okay. We'll go to you, Mr. Sabakul.
Your Honor, if we might have a 5-minute recess so I can call my witness and make sure they can call in.
Sure.
Thank you.
Steve won't go back on record.
We're going to go back on the record here. It's about 2:15. We've got all three commissioners. Mr. Savickul, you were trying to get a witness on the phone?
I believe Ms. Maney is on the phone. Ms. Maney, are you here?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Ms. Maney, I need to, I don't believe, were you here this morning when I talked about the penalty for perjury in North Dakota?
Yes, I was watching, Your Honor.
Okay. Then I'm just going to remind you that perjury is a Class C felony. A Class C felony is subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison, a fine of $10,000, or both may be imposed. Having been advised of this penalty, would you raise your right hand, please? You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Savickul.
Thank you, Your Honor. I've handed out a proposed exhibit to the parties and the commissioners and Your Honor, which we will propose to add as Exhibit 206 after a couple of questions of the witness here. Ms. Maney, do you have the table in front of you, which I handed out to the parties in this case?
Yes, I do.
And was it prepared by you or at your direction?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Can you generally walk us through what this is and where the information came from?
Yes, sure. So basically the table shows each of the classes in the first column, and the second and third column basically show the settlement allocations, so in terms of amount and the revenue responsibility share. So, for example, according to the settlement allocations, the residential class is at $51.9 million, and that's correspondingly the revenue responsibility share is 33.8%, which is basically 33.8 of the $153.6 million total revenues for Otter Tail. The next columns 3 and 4 basically show the class cost of service related allocations. And in that, for example, in the residential class, it shows that for the residential class, the class cost responsibility is 35.8% of the total or $55 million. The last column there basically is the calculation of subsidy, meaning that, for example, for the residential class, what really should be recovered according to the class cost of service study results is $55 million from that class. Where we've settled on is $51.9 million, so therefore there's a subsidy of $3.1 million to the residential class. Correspondingly, if you wanted to look at the large general service class, large general service class is subsidizing $3.1 million to other classes. And the other thing it shows is that basically the general service and the large general service classes are subsidizing all the other classes. In terms of where I got this information, essentially the settlement information, I believe, is already provided, but the cost of service allocation information was, I took that from the supplemental testimony. We had issued a discovery request asking for the latest class cost of service results, which these results were after the tax impact were incorporated in supplemental testimony, and the cost responsibilities that are shown here are from that class cost of service study result.
Ms. Maney, is that also shown in Exhibit 202, your direct testimony, page 17?
Let me check real quick here. That is correct, yes.
and that's based on the information request cited therein that we obtained, you obtained from Otter Tail Power. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
All right. And while that is a cost of service study based on supplemental testimony, would you expect the class cost of service percentages to change materially if one were run on a settlement on the settlement?
Not really. I believe that the 6.64% was a $9.7 million increase, and now we are at 7.4. I don't believe that this change in revenue requirement would necessarily materially change the cost of service shape or the relative relationship between classes.
All right.
And I can say that, for example, when I looked at the cost of service results that were from the original testimony at a 10.6% increase and then compared that to the one that had a 6.64% increase, I actually saw that the subsidy from the LGS class was more, and this is because LGS pays a high amount of taxes. But looking at the change in revenue requirement we have right now, I don't think that the cost of service relative relationships will change materially with the settlement amount.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to move on to another issue that was subject of some questions, and that would be the use of the word competitive and really the comparisons between the classes. In your direct testimony, Exhibit 202, pages 11 through 14, you speak to what we call competitive, but really is rate comparison of industrial customers to national and regional rates. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Where did you get the information in those charts that you developed?
This information was provided by Otter Tail in response to a discovery request, and it's the very same source that Mr. Gerhardsen, used to develop the charts that were in his testimony and that he discussed today.
So from
EEI
from
database, oh, yeah.
Sorry, thank you. That was the EEI database?
That's right.
Now, you do a fair amount of work in with industrial customers. Can you speak to why rates need to be competitive, and do customers look at the competitive nature of rates in a particular area for electric providers?
Yes, and you know, I'm basing my response now on anecdotal experience, but I have worked with numerous customers in the past. Ever since I've been in this business, I've supported various groups that consists of large industrial, small industrial. A lot of the industrial customers have very energy-intensive operations where energy is a big portion of their cost. And, you know, from an overall perspective, a lot of these facilities are 24/7 operations, and so energy tends to make a big portion of their bill. So when they are looking at expanding between sister facilities, let's say they have one in North Dakota and another one in Iowa, for example, no doubt a number of factors come into play when you're trying to figure out whether to expand in one location versus the other. But because these are energy-intensive facilities, energy is one important component in the decision-making. trying to see what rate look like in one location versus another is an important element in the decision-making to either expand or relocate or, for that matter, contract facilities. So in my experience, I have seen where customers take these comparisons very seriously, and it matters because some of these businesses are in intensely competitive environments, and any change in the power cost has a direct impact on their bottom line.
So I'm going to take you back to figure one on page 12 of your direct testimony, and and you've got a bar there which represents an abbreviation, WNC. What does WNC stand for?
WNC is the West North Central Region, and it covers, I have just written these states down. Bear with me, please. Okay. It covers Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, Missouri, North Dakota, and South Dakota. So it's that's the region that's covered, and these regions are identified by the EEI, the Electric Edison Institute database, as a region. So that's what the WNC stands for.
Okay, so that information came, again, out of the Edison Electric Institute database?
Yes, the AutoTail provided in response, they provided this WNC number to me, correct.
So within this region, it would be, this would be a region where an ethanol plant might be deciding where to put their facility or invest their dollars. And can you speak to what this regional analysis might, how that might come into play?
Well, you know, since you picked an ethanol plant, that would be a reasonable example to show here. As an example, is that let's say somebody's looking at an ethanol plant in Auditor Service Territory, North Dakota, versus one in Iowa. That is direct competition, and the rates in Iowa are generally more competitive, quote unquote, in the sense that we are talking about it. Compared to North Dakota. So that has a direct implication on where the demand for ethanol might be coming from, whether it's from Iowa or whether it's from North Dakota.
All right.
Before you get to your next question, did you move the exhibit yet?
I have not, Your Honor. Thank
okay.
you.
Do you want to do that?
I would. MLEC moves, offers exhibit 206 for the record.
Good counsel. Mr. Stephenson?
No objection.
Mr. Pelham?
No objection.
Mr. Wachorek?
No objection.
And Ms. Jeffcoat-Sack?
No objection.
Okay, then MLEC exhibit 206 is admitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sorry for the interruption.
Nope, I appreciate it. And with that, I've got no further questions for Ms. Maney, and I offer her for cross-examination.
Okay. Mr. Stephenson, questions for Ms. Maney?
No questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Pelham?
No questions.
Mr. Wieczorek?
No questions.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacko?
No questions.
Okay. Commissioners, Commissioner Crocius?
Just a couple of questions for you.
Sure.
Are there instances that you're aware of where rate has driven? You had cited someone may move a business to Iowa or pick Iowa instead. Do you have anything specific that has ever been tied to utility rates?
Yeah, as I was saying, Commissioner, I believe that if I couldn't honestly say that energy rate is the factor in relocating or choosing a site, but I can tell you through experience that it is one of the top 5 or 10 things that issues that companies seriously look at to figure out where they would like to expand or relocate.
Sure, and that's fair. I think to get a clear picture, do you know, you had cited Iowa just, or even surrounding states, any state for that matter. Would you agree or believe that there is also subsidization between customer classes in other states in terms of rate structure and design?
You know, I can't speak to those directly because I don't remember offhand of what they are. But I would tend to agree that, you know, states generally do have some level of subsidization. I think different states are figuring out different ways of moving into costs. And, you know, by and large, a cost of service study results are a very important guide towards getting closer to cost and being fair, because if one particular class is subsidizing, is getting subsidized, that means some other class is paying for that subsidy, which in turn could make the difference between a competitive rate and a non-competitive rate. And so, you know, from my perspective, I believe that the commission in various jurisdictions, they do look at a lot of factors. They look at gradualism, they look at rate competitiveness, and cost of service is a very important guide to help guide the rate design and allocation.
Sure. Do you think that that could be mitigated by economic development riders?
You know, personally, Commissioner, I believe that if rates were closely aligned with costs, we may not need economic development. That's my personal opinion. But I think it's hard to say to what extent economic development can be effective or not, you know, whether the rates are responsible for the rate design that somebody is looking at. Has led to that or not, it's hard for me to say. I think it's a very specific situation one needs to look at before rendering any kind of decision on that.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and this is probably just more of a comment than a question. North Dakota has traditionally been a low-cost state in terms of doing business. And maybe our biggest challenge is finding available labor at times, but we have a very attractive corporate tax rate structure in comparison to, for example, our neighbors to the east. So I do agree that there are a number of factors that do come into play. No other questions for me. Thank you.
Chairman Chrisman.
I'm just curious in your experience, and especially in these last number of years where many companies that I talk to express a concern that finding good help is one of their biggest problems. And so when it gets down to just a one class versus another here where potentially the large commercial might be subsidizing residential, would the companies look at that as a push because having the low residential rates will also help them attract employees to an area?
Well, you know, that's a fair question, Commissioner. I think that maybe there could be another way of the same thing could be turned on its head to say that if there were competitive rates, you would have more expansions in the state, all things held equal. If there's more expansion, then there's more employment, there's more tax revenues. So I tend to look at it from that perspective too. And my other point here would be that, you know, we did look at gradualism. You know, if we were really that staunch and we wanted to go exactly at cost, we would have had $3 million less of revenues from our class. But we totally recognize that it's important to consider gradualism. We also think it's important to get closer to cost, and we also think it's important to look at rate competitiveness. And when we as a group looked at all three together, we felt that the settlement was a good balance between all three of those points.
Okay, thank you for that. And I apologize, I didn't bring every binder full of material along over here with me, and so I don't have yours. So for my notes, would you refresh me on the spelling of your name and then your credentials or background as a witness?
Oh, of course. I'll be glad to. My name is Kabita Maney, K-A-B-I-T-A. Last name Maney, M as in Michael, A-I-N-I. I'm known in the industry as Kavita because there are not very many Kavitas out here. basically, I've been in this energy industry since 1991. I worked for a utility when I started off my career. I worked for a utility in Madison called Wisconsin Power and Light till about 1997. Then I went and joined a consulting firm for a year or two in San Diego. Then we came back to the Wisconsin area, and I worked for Alliant again. And then in 2003, I became an independent consultant. And since then, I've basically, supported energy groups, helped out industrial customers, public service commissions also in other jurisdictions. And by education, I have a master's in business and a master's in applied economics, both from Marquette University in Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Sure.
Oh, I'm done, Your Honor.
Okay, Commissioner Fedorchak.
Thank you, Ms. Maney. I just have one question, and that is, do you have an opinion on, or does your group have an opinion on the economic development dollars, not the rider that the company is proposing on another case, but the inclusion of economic development dollars in rate base and customers like yours paying for those types of dollars that are used to support grants in various communities for the purpose of economic development?
Yeah, I was watching that discussion during the day. Our group did not take a position in that matter. So I guess at this point, right now, I don't have a position regarding that matter.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
That's it for me. Thanks.
Okay. Back to counsel, Mr. Savakul.
Nothing, Your Honor.
Mr. Stephenson.
Nothing, Your Honor.
Mr. Pelham.
Nothing, Your Honor.
Mr. Wysorek.
None, Your Honor.
And Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Nothing, thanks.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks, Ms. Maney.
Thank you. I'll hang up now then, huh?
Yes, you can.
Thank you.
Your Honor, with our other witnesses having stipulated to their testimony, we don't have anything else to offer
okay.
at this time.
All right. Thanks. So you rest. Mr. Wysorek, do you have anything as far as, are you going to call a witness or?
I will not, Your Honor. We have, with the exhibits, his testimony was admitted. Unless the commission has specific questions on his testimony, I will not call him.
Commission, have any questions for his witness?
I do not.
Okay. No. Okay. So the answer is no. Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
We have nothing further.
All right. I guess that brings us close to the end of the day. I'm just going to call out. I don't see anyone here who might be a member of the public, but just in case, is there anyone here who wishes to make public input at this time in regard to this matter or this settlement agreement? Seeing none. We'll pass over the rest of that discussion. And I guess at this point, counsel, we should probably talk about late-filed exhibits now. I have two in my notes, one from the company, one from staff, but we may have already gotten that from MLEC. The one that I had, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco requested a document showing the impact of lowering the percentage increase of COS to the residential. Is that something we're still looking for?
Well, it was less in the customer charge, more in volumetric.
Yeah,
it
okay.
It was not a request to change what was allocated to residential.
Why don't you kind of summarize for me? Are you still requesting that be provided?
I think so. I mean, I maybe one or two scenarios. You know, instead of 15, it's 13 or it's 11 or something, or cut it in half, or I don't know. A company can propose a scenario or two.
Okay. Can you tell me what we want to call that exhibit so I can get that now?
I think it's the impact of allocating less of the residential increase to the fixed charge.
And so that will be late filed, that will be OTP 53. And then the other one that was requested, I believe, was requested by Commissioner Fedorchak from staff. And I understand, Victor, that was a calculation of the various components of the difference between the $900,000 position and the $7.3 million settlement amount. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so that'll also be a late filed exhibit.
What number is that, Your Honor?
Let me just check where we're at with OTP. PSC 7. All right. Then at this point, Mr. Stephenson, any other rebuttal case or anything else you want to put in today?
No rebuttal case, Your Honor, but we would like to go on the record and address two issues. The adoption of which we would not view as contrary to or a violation of the settlement agreement, and specifically, we would not oppose reducing the residential customer charge to $14 and to eliminate the economic development item from recovery, and that is, I think, approximately $200,000. So we did want to put that on the record, and we would be happy to address this in a proposed order for the commission or any other fashion that would be deemed appropriate.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Pelham, any response to that?
I don't have any response to that. I think generally advocacy staff certainly is not opposed to that. And ultimately, it will be a decision for the commission.
Okay. Mr. Savakul.
No objection to that, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Wazorik, any objection to that proposed amendment to the settlement agreement?
None, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
None. I appreciate the offer.
Okay. All right. I guess then I'll listen to closing remarks from counsel, if you have any others. Mr. Stephens?
Really none, Your Honor, other than to say we appreciate the opportunity to appear here today and all the hard work that staff has done and the interveners. We do appreciate it, and we hope to see this matter to conclusion.
Okay. Mr. Pelham?
Just briefly, I'd echo Mr. Stephenson's comments just now. It is an adversarial proceeding here today. At the same time, advocacy staff, from his perspective, was appreciative to all of the parties, interveners, and Otter Tail, its staff, and in crafting the proposed settlement agreement that's before the commission. So thank you.
Mr. Savakul.
I would say the same thing, so I will refrain from it. Thank you.
Mr. Wazorik, closing remarks from counsel?
Express my appreciation for allowing me to appear telephonically and support the settlement document with the proposals of Otter Tail.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Nothing. Thank you.
All right. Commissioners, I'll ask for your closing comments at this point. Mr. Crocius.
Well, thank you, everyone, for all of your hard work. We condensed a potentially three-day hearing into, if my math is correct, not quite 6 hours with a lunch break. which really doesn't reflect how much work and effort has gone into making so many different calculations and the analysis. I've got a few more numbers myself to crunch, but I do appreciate the work that everyone has done on this. And Otter Tail Council's remarks and concessions that they would be willing to make in the settlement. Appreciate that as well. So I really don't have anything else to add other than next steps for me would be to do some more analysis and work my way through a few more numbers and see where we land on that or where I do. And then compare notes with the other commissioners and staff, of course, along the way. But thank you, everyone, for your hard work. I really do appreciate it.
Chairman Chrisman.
Not much to add to that. It's one thing to point out that comparing notes is in an open public meeting, of course. You meant to say?
Of course. that's implied, always.
As I said in the beginning, because of other commitments, this settlement really didn't leave as much time to prepare for as what Friday to Wednesday might look like on the calendar. But I have gained a great deal of additional understanding throughout this hearing, so I appreciate that, and also appreciate that willingness to potentially make a couple of amendments to the settlement. Especially on that economic development rider. I think that's very important. So thank you, everyone, and have a good day.
Mr. Fedorchak.
Well, I have to differ a bit from Mandy in that I actually thought the settlement came in kind of early. I mean, we met them the night before, so actually having on Friday with the whole weekend to evaluate that instead of trying to get to the bottom of the numbers in their testimony and rebuttal testimony, et cetera, was appreciated. I learned a lot today. Thanks for your patience in explaining everything and going through and providing some good clarity to how you got to where we are and also to make some concessions on some issues that are important. So I think we'll should be able to work through this in relative ease and without a lot of delay and get to a decision soon. Thank you.
So, Council, I'm thinking July 27th for these late-filed exhibits and the proposed order and findings of fact. Is that sufficient? I mean, can we do it by then?
Yes.
Okay. All right. On July 27th it is. And anything else today for the good of the order, Mr. Stephenson?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Pelham?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Savokal?
Nothing, Your Honor.
Mr. Wazorik?
Nothing, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Nothing, thank you.
Okay, I want to also echo just my thanks again for the hard work that obviously went into the settlement and the organization and the presentation today. Thank you all very much. It's greatly appreciated. And at this point, I'll close the hearing on the application of Otter Tail Power, case number PU-17398, subject to the filing of late-filed exhibits. And we're off the record at approximately...